Hello, welcome to New Books in Buddhist Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm Luke Thompson, one of the hosts of the channel. Today I'll be speaking with Scott Mitchell about his recent book, Buddhism in America, Global Religion, Local Contexts, published by Bloomsbury in 2016. This work provides a much-needed, up-to-date overview of Buddhism in the United States. To tackle such a large topic, Mitchell draws on Thomas Tweed's work and approaches American Buddhism as comprising worldviews and sets of practices that are born of local circumstances, but which can be firmly located within global cultural networks that extend far beyond the local and beyond America. The book is usefully divided into three sections. In the first, Mitchell provides a short introduction to Buddhism and then discusses the history of Buddhism in the U.S. up to around the 1960s. Here he also touches on the 19th century European interest in Buddhism, on the ways in which U.S. immigration policy influenced Buddhist demographics, and on the Zen boom of the 1950s. The second section presents a rich overview of Buddhism in the U.S., organized according to a tripartite distinction between Theravada traditions, East Asian Mahayana traditions, and Vajrayana traditions, including Japanese esoteric Buddhism. For anyone who wants to know who established what temple or group and when, this is essential reading. A third section then addresses a handful of themes or developments through which to examine American Buddhism more broadly. Here Mitchell sheds fresh light on a number of issues that will be familiar to anyone involved with Buddhism in the U.S. For example, he examines commercial uses of Buddhist ideas and imagery, but goes beyond characterizing such uses as mere cultural appropriation for monetary ends by providing examples in which it is practicing Buddhists themselves who are behind the commercial use. Here he also looks at visual art and literature that straddles the border between Buddhist and non-Buddhist, thus bringing our attention to the gray area in which readers' notions of what is and is not Buddhism are challenged. Other topics addressed in this third section include issues around identity, pan-Buddhist and secular Buddhist movements, and various forms of socially engaged Buddhism. In the interview, we only touch on a few of these topics, and readers will have to pick up a copy for themselves to appreciate the full scope of the volume. The book is in part designed to be used in the classroom, and each chapter is accompanied by a useful chapter overview, discussion questions, and a list for further reading. That being said, the book offers a wealth of information, and is thus a must-read for any scholar wanting to know about the history and current state of American Buddhism. Furthermore, written in clear prose as it is, the book can also be enjoyed by those without a prior understanding of Buddhism, and it will provide anyone who is interested with the most up-to-date and comprehensive account of American Buddhism currently available. I hope you enjoy the interview. Hello, listeners, and welcome back to New Books in Buddhist Studies. Today I'm with Scott Mitchell, and we'll be talking about his recent book, Buddhism in America, Global Religion, Local Contexts, published by Bloomsbury in 2016. Scott Mitchell is the Reverend Yoshitaka Tamai Professor of Jodo Shinshu Buddhist Studies at the Institute of Buddhist Studies in Berkeley, California, where he also serves as the Dean of Students and Faculty Affairs. His research focuses primarily on Buddhism in the United States, on the Jodo Shinshu, being the Japanese true Pure Land School of Buddhism, and on portrayals of Buddhism in the media. Scott, welcome to the show, and thanks for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
I wanted to ask you to begin by telling us how you came to the study of Buddhism, and perhaps more specifically to the study of Buddhism as it is practiced in the United States.
Sure. So my interest in Buddhism began probably the same way a lot of folks in our field began in college. My first year in college, I took a course on the history of the Vietnam War era conflict. And, you know, first week or so in the class, the professor gave a short overview of pre-colonial Vietnamese history and culture, which included a short little riff on Buddhism. And I think at the time I was the kind of kid who was always asking the big philosophical questions, and something about that short overview of Buddhism really fascinated me. And so over the course of my undergraduate career, I studied more and more about Buddhism and eventually changed my major to philosophy and religion. And, you know, I jokingly say that when you have a degree in philosophy, you pretty much have to go to grad school. So I decided that what I really wanted to do was teach. So I went to grad school to get my doctorate, and that was when, in my first year in grad school, I took a course, I think it was called something like, East Meets West, and it was about, the encounter between Buddhism and Western culture. And that class was fascinating to me for a lot of reasons, and one was just the realization that there was this very long, complicated cultural history, as Buddhism moves into Western cultural contexts, and, that sparked my imagination. You know, I went into grad school sort of with this idea that I would be doing comparative religious studies, and quickly realized that my real passion was just doing Buddhist studies work. So that's how I focused, ended up focusing my graduate work on Buddhism as practiced in the United States.
Great. So the book we're discussing today is an overview of Buddhism in the United States. And I want to ask how you see this book fitting into the broader study of American Buddhism. And for listeners who aren't familiar with the study of Buddhism in America, perhaps you could just say something briefly about the history of that particular area of research.
Sure. So my feeling is that the study of Buddhism in the West is Buddhism in the West has been understudied and hasn't really only really very recently has the study of Buddhism in the West been taken seriously by Buddhist studies more generally. Buddhist studies as an academic field tends to focus on Asia, on textual studies or history. And, you know, fortunately, I think Buddhist studies has benefited recently with more anthropological approaches and that sort of thing. But that the focus on the United States in particular, or the West in general, has been somewhat slow to develop, I think. Hmm. And that's changed a lot in the last couple decades. And a lot of stuff has been published on this subject. So one of the challenges of this book was to get a handle on this constantly changing, developing field, as well as a pretty diverse subject. Interestingly, I think one of the trajectories that we see in the study of Buddhism in the West is to actually get away from a regional or area studies model. You know, traditionally, Buddhist studies scholars, I think, sort of specialize in a particular part of the world, you know, East Asia with a specialty in Japan kind of thing. And for those who work on the West, there's a similar corollary. You know, I study Buddhism in the West with a particular interest in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, though, it seems that the trajectory is sort of moving to more transnational models and sort of away from an area studies approach. So one of the first things that came to me when I started conceptualizing this book was, how do I talk about a bounded category of Buddhism in the United States while paying attention to current trends in the field that are sort of rejecting that model?
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to be able to locate Buddhism within, you know, the United with U.S. Buddhism within a sort of global modern discourse.
Sure. Great. So the book's divided into three sections, and in the first, you provide a historical overview of Buddhism in the U.S. Here you address the early modern European interest in Buddhism, and then discuss the 19th century introduction of Buddhism into the U.S., the effect of federal immigration policy on the Buddhist population or on U.S. Buddhist demographics, and also the surge of interest in Japanese Zen that we see in the 1950s. The second part of the book is organized around three broad traditions: Theravada Buddhism, East Asian Mahayana Buddhism, and Tibetan Buddhism. And you actually include Japanese forms of esoteric Buddhism within your discussion of Tibetan Buddhism. And finally, in the third section of the book, you have three chapters organized around a handful of themes or issues that all Buddhists and Buddhist groups in the U.S. have had to address. So I want to ask how you came to organize the book in this particular manner. And in your answer, I was wondering if you could also touch on your use of Thomas Tweed's translocal analysis.
Sure. So, you know, a lot of the organization of the book, I think, probably derived on some level from the way I actually teach the subject. I've been teaching a graduate seminar on Buddhism in the West for 7 or 8 years now. And this is one of the ways that I generally approach the subject, is to start the semester off by talking about the history of the tradition and then sort of move into topical issues or frames, like I say in the book, or theory and method kind of thing. I'm a believer in the idea that you sort of have to begin with history just to sort of understand where the tradition came from, what sort of historical issues has helped shape it, to sort of provide you with some foundation as you move into larger, more contemporary issues. I tend to find that most of my students are very concerned about contemporary issues, sort of current events. which is great, but it's also good to know that, that current events are the result of history, right? So part of my approach was to sort of naturally say, well, I want to begin the book with a cursory overview of the history, not just of Buddhism in the West, but also Buddhism's larger history. Buddhism in the West has a very short history relative to the entire history of the traditions, right? So to contextualize more recent history with the large sweep of history going back to the historical Buddha. The second section, I know I needed to include a sort of survey of the landscape, so to speak, of, you know, what different kinds of Buddhist groups are here. And then the third section, as you said, is sort of topical frames to, that Buddhist groups are wrestling with, or also methodological approaches that scholars have used to talk about the traditions. I think those are sort of two sides of the same coin. Tweed's work was very important to me in thinking through how I wanted to tell this story. As I said before, there's this, I think the trajectory of the field has been moving more toward translocal studies. Mm-hmm. But Tweed's larger point, one of his phrases is that scholars should follow the flows, right? And he's talking about the sort of cultural flows that the tradition flows along, either through choice or through just by being pushed along by history or immigration policies or whatnot. And that's one way to sort of approach the subject and understand how Buddhism is manifested in this country as a result of larger transnational forces. And I also wanted to play with the idea of how in his larger sort of metaphor about this, Tweed talks a lot about rivers and coming together and flowing apart. And so I wanted to build on that by talking about convergence and divergence and the way that different cultural discourses and movements of persons came together in some literal ways to sometimes create new forms of Buddhism, but then also diverged and took separate different paths. And this was, in some ways, in thinking through the way in which Buddhist history in the United States is often told on a very case-by-case basis. You know, people look at this particular tradition, some kind of an isolation, and sort of create silos, right, of different traditions that seem to have nothing to do with one another. Mm-hmm. When writing a book like this, that's a survey of everything, an impossible task, I wanted to demonstrate the points of contact and where different traditions have come together or influenced one another, and honestly have sometimes broken off and created their own silos and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do that on different layers within the book, both in terms of the history, but also in making connections in the methodological frames chapters, or playing with the idea of bringing esoteric Japanese Buddhism into conversation with Tibetan esoteric Buddhism, and see what that would look like.
Yeah, great. So in the beginning of the book, you address some of the ways of immigration that first brought Buddhism to the United States, and among these was a movement of several thousand Chinese immigrants coming in the mid-ninth century as part of the California Gold Rush, and then later a stream of Japanese immigrants arriving in Hawaii and California beginning in the late 19th century. I wanted to first ask why it was that the Buddhism that these early Chinese immigrants brought did not last beyond the 19th century. And after that, I wanted you to address the dominant role that Japanese Buddhism played in introducing to Americans to Buddhism in the first half of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. I think in terms of the early Chinese immigration, I think that there's a chance that some early Chinese Buddhist or religious groups make it into the 20th century. But the thing to know is that this early great group of immigrants were primarily laborers who first, tried to work on the gold mine fields and then were kicked off and then built the Transcontinental Railroad and then were sort of forced out of the Midwest and the mountain states and back into, usually Los Angeles or San Francisco. And not a ton of work has been done on this particular period of history. And so I think that's a really good open question. To what extent did these communities, survive or thrive or establish themselves, if at all, I know folks like Stuart Chandler done some work on that. And, you know, as an aside, one of the things I wanted to do in this book was sort of point toward future research vistas and sort of challenge people to ask these questions and go out and do more research. But the big issue, of course, with early Chinese immigration is that anti-Chinese sentiment was so incredibly strong in this country in the late 1800s that it was very difficult to establish an immigrant community. Of course, there was the Chinese Exclusion Act that was passed that ended immigration from China. Asian immigrants were subject to Jim Crow laws like other people of color, and so that disenfranchised them pretty strongly. And then there was the overt pressure from the dominant culture to blend in and convert basically to Christianity. And so I think that combination of factors made it extraordinarily difficult for these this first wave of immigrants to establish a community and to really establish Buddhism. And I would also be curious to speak with scholars who are specialists in this particular era of Chinese Buddhism, because one of the differences here with the Japanese immigrants is that once the Japanese immigrants came to Hawaii and then the West Coast, they often petitioned organizations back into Japan to send priests to America to help establish new communities. That says something about the relative stability and strength of Japanese Buddhism at the time, and I would be curious to know what was going on the ground in China in the mid-1800s that would have allowed for that kind of proselytization, if you will,
yes,
or missionizing in the way that we see from Japan. Because, you know, by the time Japanese immigrants are coming to the United States, that's the era of the Meiji Restoration in Japan, and Buddhism is going through this period of rapid modernization. And folks are missionizing. They're
yeah.
trying very hard yeah. to promote Japanese Buddhism and to make the case that Japanese Buddhism is a modern, rational religion that can compete, so to speak, on the global stage. And they're sending people overseas, both for immigrant communities, but also to things like the World Parliament of Religion, which leads into that second part of your question, which is the sort of the way in which I think most Americans probably understood Buddhism in the first part of the 20th century was through a Japanese lens. Both because on the ground, the only communities that had really been established by this point were Japanese communities. And then intellectually, a lot of the work that's being done in English in the first part of the 20th century is being done in conversation with Japanese Buddhist scholars and scholarship. And so those perspectives on Buddhism get foregrounded. For a pretty significant period of time until after World War II, and you know, really even until the 1960s. You know, going back to the Beats, it's interesting to me that, you know, Gary Snyder is this college kid who wants to know more about Buddhism, and, you know, he comes to Berkeley, and, you know, he goes to a Jodo Shinshu temple because that's really like the only temple in town. you know, had there been Tibetans here at the time, or Thai Buddhists or whatnot, you know, that might have been a different story. So that's sort of where I'm sort of pointing out the way things were very different before World War II in Americans' understanding of Buddhism.
Sure. So, you know, basically in 1950, if you wanted to look around for a Buddhist temple and America, the chances that it would be a Japanese Buddhist temple are very high. But
yeah.
You note that this begins to change with the Cart Seller Act of 1965. What did that particular piece of legislation do to Buddhist demographics in the U.S.?
Well, the Cart Seller Act removed, you know, nearly 75 years of U.S. immigration policy that that banned immigration from most of Asia and put pretty strong quotas on countries around the world. Basically, the quota system was the U.S. population had to have, you know, you could only let in certain numbers of people from countries around the world if they already had, you know, a population here in the U.S. So there was virtually no immigration from Asia for a very long period of time. And the Hart-Celler Act was passed in 65, and, you know, within 5-7 years of that law being enacted, things in Southeast Asia go from bad to worse, and we see several different different interrelated crises as a result of the Vietnam war, as well as the military coup in Burma that created various refugee crises, and of course what's going on in mainland China with the Cultural Revolution. So there's a lot of things going on in Asia that compel people to leave Asia and make their way here to the United States. So just on the ground, you see the beginnings by the early 1970s of the establishment of a wide diversity of Buddhist communities from virtually all parts of Buddhist Asia, which is a distinct difference from pre-World War II, where, you know, like we said, it's mostly just Japanese immigrants. But I also think that the other thing to remember about that particular period of U.S. cultural history is that there's a new openness going on in the United States where we're more interested in Asia, both, you know, politically or militarily because of what's going on in Vietnam and other parts of Southeast Asia, but also, with new institutions like the Peace Corps being established and this, you know, then of course the countercultural, movement and whatnot, where there's this interest on the part of many young Americans to learn more about, Eastern religions that, has the effect of both allowing people to travel to Asia and learn about Buddhism in its Asian contexts, but also to be open to immigrants and refugees and Buddhists coming into the country and coming into contact with them here. So I note some parallels in the development of American Buddhist communities in the 1970s and 80s with that earlier generation of Japanese immigrants. Mm-hmm. But some distinct differences where the anti-Japanese and anti-Asian sentiment of early 20th century is not as strong as mm-hmm. it is in the late 20th century. And so that, I think, allows for both the establishment of these communities, but also for their eventual further growth and success. In a way that, you know, doesn't seem to happen, will happen, but, you know, in a different way from earlier immigration.
Great. So near the end of the first section of your book, you introduce the idea of parallel congregations. What is this, and how is this an accurate description of Buddhism in the U.S. in the latter part of the 20th century?
Well, the idea of parallel congregations is an idea that Paul David Numerick actually came up with in his ethnographic study of Sri Lankan and Thai Buddhism here in the U.S., mostly Sri Lankan Buddhism. And what he noted was that that there seemed to be within these communities parallel congregations, one being the immigrants or native-born Sri Lankan Americans who were practicing Buddhism in one particular way, and then converts to the community, usually white converts who had a different interests in Buddhism. And he suggested that it seemed as though these two congregations within one community were sort of somewhat mutually isolated or were pursuing different activities. You know, the Asian Americans doing more, I think what he would call cultural practices, and the white converts doing more meditation. I think some other folks have tried to look at this parallelism on a larger scale, and I think we can see some of that in American Zen, where there are definitely communities of Zen in America that are predominantly populated by converts and their descendants, and then communities that are populated by Japanese Americans and their descendants, and they're parallel. They're not necessarily intersecting. But at the same time, over the last 10, 15 years, my sense has been that there's been more interaction between these communities and more points of contact. And other scholars have wondered whether or not that parallelism is something that will last into the future, or if it was merely a factor of what was happening at a particular moment in time. That's one of the fun and challenging things about this area of study, is that things change very rapidly when you're talking about current events. And some of the early scholarship on Buddhism in America, I think, needs to be revisited and sort of looked at again and questioned whether or not it, again, is reflecting a particular moment in time, or if things on the ground are actually beginning to change, or if they're not.
Great. So I want to turn to the second section of the book, and In this section, you provide a fascinating history of Buddhism in the U.S., devoting a chapter each to Theravada traditions, to Mahayana, largely East Asian traditions, and then to tantric or esoteric Buddhist traditions, which in this case refers to Tibetan Buddhism as practiced not only in the Himalayas, but also in parts of Russia and Mongolia, as well as to Japanese esoteric Buddhism. Now, I want to skip over much of the specific information you present here, since there's simply too much to mention, and listeners will have to go read it for themselves. But I do want to touch on the final chapter in this section, in which you discuss some of the trends that emerge from a situation in which a large number of culturally distinct and sometimes mutually unintelligible Buddhist traditions exist within the same country and have to make sense of one another. And one trend that you explore is that of non-sectarian or pan-sectarian Buddhism. So what does this look like, and could you give us an example?
Sure. So here I was interested in, arbitrarily followed the categorization scheme of Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana, which is not, any categorization scheme is imperfect. But one of the challenges, as you note, in the United States is that there's just this wealth of different Buddhist traditions that invariably commingle, so to speak, and have to figure out what to do with each other. And sometimes that response might be to sort of dig your heels in and become more solidly sectarian. But in other cases, what happens is we see different traditions sort of merging together. So one example of that is the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, which, was started by Robert Aiken and some other folks in Hawaii. And when I say some other folks, Aiken is coming from a Japanese Zen tradition, and the people that he's working with are coming from Pure Land tradition, from Theravada traditions, from different Zen lineages. So it's this mixture of different Buddhist approaches in pursuit of a particular approach to Buddhism that's socially and environmentally engaged. And so here we see a shift away from a Buddhist practice or a Buddhist identity that's grounded in what might be considered a sort of typical or traditional lineage, and instead is focused on arguably a non-Buddhist cause, environmental engagement, for example. And the practices that are being brought into this tradition, or the perspectives or the doctrines or whatnot, are coming from different Buddhist lineages. And so from that point of view, it's sort of a pan-Buddhist organization, because it's not limited to one lineage, or you might say it's non-sectarian, because they're not claiming a sectarian identity in the way that a Zen Buddhist might, right? And so another example might be the East Bay Meditation Center, which similarly was founded by Buddhists from multiple traditions, and again, they're bringing to the table various perspectives and practices from the Zen lineage, as well as sort of the insight meditation lineage, and in some Tibetan practices as well. And so I'm not the point of this chapter was to sort of play with what, again, might be future trajectories, or they might just be, a particular moment in time. But some of these issues, I think, have some legs, and will carry on into the development of possibly new, wholly new traditions in the years to come.
Great. And another trend that you mentioned here is that of secular Buddhism, with mindfulness-based groups being, in some cases, a typical example. How has secular Buddhism fared in the U.S., and do you see it as a sort of significant aspect of American Buddhism currently?
Yeah, I think it's a very significant aspect. I think that secular Buddhism can be looked at from a couple different perspectives. There's an actual organization called the Secular Buddhist Association, which sort of points toward the possibility of a community of like-minded Buddhists who are approaching the tradition from a particular way. But there's also the sort of larger discursive or rhetorical aspect of secular Buddhism, which is, to grossly oversimplify things, a critique of a sort of modern and or pre-modern perspectives on Buddhism, largely around issues of soteriology or faith or mythology, right? So there's this rejection of a sort of traditional understanding of Buddhist cosmology, a rejection of things like rebirth or karma being related necessarily to your reincarnation and being more the universal law of cause and effect. Oftentimes that gets sort of coupled with the idea that Buddhism is compatible with science. And so here we see a sort of hallmark of a modern Buddhist discourse that situates Buddhism as being consonant with principles of modern science. And on that level, I think that this sort of approach to Buddhism as being of sort of pushing Buddhism to be more secular, I think, has had an influence not only on individual Buddhists or organizations, but on what we might consider more traditional Buddhist groups as well, that have to negotiate that new space and have to sort of make a claim or an argument about who they are as Buddhists in response to those concerns. And in terms of the mindfulness movement, this plays out in a related way, but it's somewhat different to the extent that that mindfulness, meditation, and other practices are being sort of deployed in secular spaces. So this is the other sense of the word secular, as secular institutions such as public schools or hospitals or that kind of thing, where folks are looking at the benefits of mindfulness meditation or other Buddhist practices from a therapeutic point of view. This issue has been the source of some consternation among different Buddhist groups for a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. There are some folks who feel that you can't take these practices out of their Buddhist context and divorce them of ethical of concerns or soteriological goals. Mm-hmm. Then there are others who say, well, there's a sort of proven track record where these practices have helped people who are dealing with chronic pain or depression or other issues. And then the rejoinder is usually, well, those scientific studies are actually not that consistent. We need to do a meta-analysis of that. Mm-hmm. So there's a sort of large ongoing debate about what all of this means, and different folks have sort of taken it in different directions. And Jeff Wilson has a sort of has written a book called Mindful America on this topic, and he argues in part that this in the abstract, this is one of those ways that Buddhism has tried to adapt itself to a new cultural context. And there's some validity that, again, it's a moving target. And, I think that different people have different stakes in the game, as far as what they think, the outcome should be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That topic in particular, I imagine, is quite difficult to research because it's sort of constantly changing and so current.
The parts where I mentioned mindfulness in the book, I rewrote up until the last minute.
Mm. Yeah.
To try to make sure that I was getting the most sort of current.
Right.
And, as I said before, this is a constantly changing thing, and I imagine that but my book will feel dated in some ways within a few years because of these kinds of developments.
Yeah. Well, so moving on to the third and final section of the book, you turn your attention to a number of what you call frames, and these are themes or issues common to most forms of American Buddhism, or alternatively, they are areas of focus that we can use to better understand the nature of American Buddhism and how it's changing. You begin this section with a chapter on the mediation of Buddhism, mediation through visual representations, literary expression, and so forth. And you note that it is in this area that Buddhism most clearly interacts with and sometimes blends into explicitly non-Buddhist areas of society. For example, you mentioned that among the writings of the Beat authors, there were works that could be regarded as explicitly Buddhist, but then there are many works that are inspired by Buddhism, but probably wouldn't necessarily be located squarely within a Buddhist tradition or recognizable Buddhist culture. So how does examining such works help us understand Buddhism in the U.S.?
Yeah, so, to kind of go back to the things I was saying about Thomas Tweed's work and the way in which culture sort of flows in together and flows out together, Tweed is also known for coming up with this phrase, Buddhist sympathizers or nightstand Buddhists, and he noted back in the 90s that there was this this trend of folks who are sort of tangentially interested in Buddhism, but for whatever reason don't self-identify as such. And I think what he's really pointing at is the way in which you know, Buddhism or Buddhists, these are bounded categories. If I claim that I'm a Buddhist, I'm also making the claim that I'm not something else, right? But as we know, culture doesn't always pay attention to our rules, right? So culture has this way of going beyond whatever sort of categories we put on it. And I think this is particularly true when we're talking about creative arts, literature, art, film, those kinds of things. You know, we like to say that there are genres, for example, of fiction or film or of music, but oftentimes artists intentionally play with those genre boundaries, right? Mm-hmm. And that, I think, creates a cultural space where Buddhism can enter into a new cultural context in a way that's not as deliberate or explicit as, you know, creating a new meditation center or a new temple. Mm-hmm. You know, if I go in and make a new temple, I'm literally making a claim on the ground, right? This right. is where Buddhism is. But if Buddhism shows up in pop culture, then you can also look at the way in which Buddhism is having an effect on our culture in a more subtle and indirect way. It's not always unproblematic, to be sure, and I think one of the fertile areas of research here is to look at the way in which this happens, and you know, there's all kinds of questions about the authenticity of it, or whether or not we want to make the claim that this piece of art is Buddhist and this one isn't, and all those kinds of things are certainly worth exploring. But the underlying issue here, for me, has always been to explore the way in which Buddhism pops up in different aspects of culture as a reflection not only of Buddhism, but as a reflection of how we think of ourselves as a people, as Americans, right? How do we sort of understand our place in the world? How do we envision ourselves? What stories do we tell about ourselves? And how does Buddhism get sort of implicated in all of that, which is, you know, that's a much bigger, that's a book in and of itself. No
right.
doubt.
So, and in this chapter, you also explored the use of Buddhist imagery and ideas for more explicitly commercial ends. And you give one example you give is the smoothie company Jamba Juice's production of a line of drinks called Enlightening Smoothies beginning in 2003, the bottles of which featured an image based on the Tibetan Tonka paintings. So how does the commercialization of Buddhist imagery work in the U.S., and what have been some, to what extent has this been controversial among Buddhist groups?
It's hugely controversial. I think the concern, there's a couple different concerns. One has to do with just the use of images. You know, Buddhist images have very specific meanings and functions and purposes in Buddhist history. You know, there's specific ways that icons or statues have to be situated or represented or presented, right? Great care must be taken with these images. So one line of critique has to do with, well, if you take this image of the Buddha and slap it on a bumper sticker, are you somehow disrespecting that image and then by extension the religion or persons practicing it? And those arguments, I think, are valid and oftentimes have to sort of be looked at on a case-by-case basis. I think I also mentioned in the book the case of a toilet brush holder that was being sold with images of the Buddha on it. And right. there was a clear example where there's a taboo against having an image on the floor, let alone anywhere near a toilet. Mm-hmm. and so that's an example of like, well, you know, you probably shouldn't do that.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, the sort of larger theoretical or methodological question that I'm pointing at here has to do with postcolonial studies and Orientalism. And the way in which, for a pretty long period of time, Western cultures have kind of mined Asian cultures for works of art or for ideas or for practices, largely to benefit themselves. And this has to do with the idea of cultural appropriation. And this is not unrelated to the concerns raised by some about mindfulness of the way in which we're sort of appropriating these practices into non-religious spaces or commercial spaces, and therefore benefiting by them in sometimes very lucrative way. Is that action moral or ethical, or does it do some damage or harm to the Buddhist tradition? I think is the fundamental question.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, from the point of view of Buddhist communities of practice, I think that's a very important question, and different communities have different ways of addressing that issue. From the point of view of the chapter that I wrote in my own perspective as a scholar, you know, one of the things about the Jamba Juice thing that I found interesting was that the artist in question was themselves a self-described practicing Buddhist.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the issues there is to sort of explore that relationship of, rather than creating a dichotomy of, you know, bad capitalists and commodifiers versus good Buddhists, is to sort of, again, see that relationship between these cultural discourses, and how do we understand that if everybody's sort of implicated in this, what then, you know, what is it no longer authentic? Is it now authentic? I mean, these are the questions as a teacher that I love to challenge my students with. And so,
yeah,
it was good to sort of throw that in the book as well.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Going back to the toilet brush example, I seem to remember some example of a bikini produced being sold in the UK that had a picture of the Buddha, you know, on it or something. I remember that was controversial in Sri Lanka.
Okay.
But so in this third section of the book, you also address the issue of Buddhist identity within the United States. And so I wanted to ask how the issues of how discussions around racial identity, ethnic, and or cultural identity have, how those discussions have appeared within American Buddhism and or affected it.
I think, you know, that question can be answered in a lot of different ways. And I'll just start by saying that, that racial politics and discourses around race are, obviously a huge important issue within American culture generally. So it should come as no surprise that issues of race come up in American Buddhism. Americans, I believe, have a pretty difficult time talking about race, and so it's not surprising to me that that American Buddhists also have a difficult time talking about it. I think how issues of race and other markers of identity have affected American Buddhism depends a lot on where and when you're looking. It's hard not to see how immigration policies in the late 1800s, early 20th century had an effect on the development of American Buddhism, as we were talking about before with Chinese and Japanese immigrants. And those policies were clearly racially motivated. You know, they were immigration policies that were explicitly designed to keep certain ethnicities out of this country.
Mm-hmm.
And then once immigrants did come to this country, as I said before, Asians were subject to Jim Crow laws, and that had an effect on their ability to become citizens. Generally, they couldn't become citizens. They couldn't own land, you know, all that kind of thing. That also has an effect on how Buddhism is being practiced in the early 20th century. And then, of course, the big issue, particularly for Japanese American Buddhists, is the internment during World War II. You know, the imprisonment of Japanese American Buddhists during that time period reinforced this idea of racial difference and reinforced the desire on the part of this community to really defend itself as authentically American, as legitimately American, and then do what it could to play the part, so to speak, to look as American as possible, basically. And this has an effect on the way in which Jodo Shinshu temples, for example, literally do practice, right? They have a practice schedule that has a Sunday morning worship service, right? And that you can see clear parallels there with sort of dominant American Protestant Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
But I think also on some level, the internment also pardon me, creates a situation where the community goes into sort of a self-preservation or self-defense kind of mode, and is less receptive to outside influences and is more concerned about preserving its own sort of niche than it is with propagation or outreach, right? So one of the interesting and somewhat tragic stories of the Beat Generation is how there's this moment in time where young curious white kids are coming into the community and trying to learn more about Buddhism, but they're coming in at a moment in time when the Beats are challenging dominant normative American culture of the 1950s, and mm-hmm. the Japanese Americans really don't want to challenge that, and you can understand why. They were literally imprisoned, so don't rock the boat kind of thing.
Right.
So you have that moment in history where you have the potential for something really amazing to happen, but because of these larger racial discourses that are going on, that just becomes challenging, to say the least, if not impossible. And so this is one of those areas where I say that we see a sort of divergence where, particularly after folks like Shinru Suzuki come to San Francisco, a new sort of strain of Zen Buddhism branches off that sort of diverges from a pre-existing Japanese American Zen community, largely along racial lines. As the field of American Buddhist studies begins to develop, then we see scholarly and popular approaches to the study of American Buddhism that tended to reinforce this by making the claim that there are basically two or three Buddhisms in the United States, and mm-hmm. Sort of matching the communities to these sort of racial categories. I think that the scholarship on that has really developed and have become quite sophisticated and quite nuanced. On the ground, I still see a lot of tension in particular communities, and oftentimes this tension is the result of change over time, right? Demographics are just shifting across the board in American Buddhist communities, and different communities have to deal with that in different ways. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, they're making a new community, like the East Bay Meditation Center. Those folks were frustrated by the traditions they came from and said, well, let's just make our own community.
Yeah.
Where we'll be as inclusive as possible. And more recently, if you look at the publications like what used to be Shambhala-san, now it's Lion's Roar, they've been doing more publishing on questions of race and identity and what that means as American Buddhists sort of struggle with these issues. America has had difficulty around the issue of race, and I don't see that going away in the general public. And so Buddhists are dealing with it in their own specific way. And not just around the dichotomy between Asians and whites, but also the way in which that discourse tends to sideline the experience of African American Buddhists, which is mm-hmm. another area of research that is very understudied. There's so much more out there that we can be doing fruitful research on. That I hope that if nothing else, this book sort of just points people in different directions.
Sure, I mean related to this, you note this idea of sort of two Buddhisms in the United States. A sort of discussion that was not started by, but sort of pushed into the foreground by a Tricycle article from 1991 by Helen Twarkoff, if that's how I pronounce her name. Mm-hmm. And so what is this idea of two Buddhisms, and how is it problematic and or useful for understanding American Buddhism?
The way in which Helen Twarkoff wrote that is problematic because she made the claim that Asian immigrants hadn't participated in creating something called American Buddhism, which is just historically not true. And the reason that's problematic is because it implies that legitimate American Buddhism is necessarily not Asian, which reinforces the idea that Asian Americans aren't American. So that's just a problematic claim. In scholarly literature, this manifests as a sort of categorization scheme, whereby scholars would make the claim that there are essentially, Buddhisms that are composed primarily of white converts on the one hand and Asian and Asian Americans on the other. As a methodology or as a typology or what have you, my feeling is that all typologies are flawed, mm-hmm. are imperfect, and methodologies sometimes work, and oftentimes methodologies also have blind spots. And so the question is just to sort of to look at that methodology or those typologies and ask the critical questions of what does this miss? Is it useful, or does it sort of get in the way of other kind of scholarship? So one question, to go back to the idea of African-American Buddhists, one of the issues here is that basically what we've done is we've said there are white convert communities and there are Asian communities. And so if you make that dichotomy and then you come across an individual or a Buddhist or a community of Black American Buddhists, then where do they fit in that typology? Mm-hmm. And so then the question just becomes, well, is that typology then useful?
Right.
if it misses something, so to speak. And so that's sort of the, I think, the pertinent question. And then there are other subtle or overt issues of privilege or racism within the typology. And Shannon Wacko-Hickey, her article, I think, is sort of the defining piece on that issue, where she points out that one of the problems of this typology is that it creates this idea that white convert communities are not defined by their ethnicity or their culture, and Asian groups are. And her argument there, of course, is that, you know, white people have culture, and our cultural biases affect the way that we practice Buddhism or develop Buddhist traditions or whatnot, and that should be a subject of critique or investigation or scholarly study, as any other culture is. So this is coming out of critical race theory, which, again, I think Hickey's article is sort of the definitive word on the subject. I feel that I didn't really add anything new to this discussion in my book, in part because other scholars have done a really fantastic job sort of parsing out those complexities. Fortunately, a lot of that scholarship is also freely available, and I often encourage my students to share it, you know, to have these conversations on the ground as well as in the academy, so that, people can start having more nuanced conversations.
Great. Thanks for that. I was actually wondering if you would care to mention something about the Institute of Buddhist Studies where you yourself teach, because that institution is itself very much a part of the story of American Buddhism.
Sure. So the Institute of Buddhist Studies was, we sort of trace our history back to 1949 as a sort of study group was established at the Berkeley Buddhist Temple. The Berkeley Buddhist Temple is a Jodo Shinshu temple. Was established here in Berkeley, I want to say, in 1911, perhaps, early part of the 20th century. After World War II, one of the things that happened with Jodo Shinshu Buddhism in America was, by World War II, the first native-born generation of Japanese Americans, usually called Nisei, had come of age and had started taking on leadership roles within the community. And there was a minister at the Berkeley Temple who had some loose connection to UC Berkeley and was very interested in education and for a lot of different reasons. You know, in part, the Berkeley Temple had a dormitory, for example, and Japanese American students studying at the university lived there for a while. And in the late 1940s and into the 1950s, there was a lot of sort of interest in learning more about Buddhism, and both in the general public, but also within the community itself. One of the issues that came to the fore was the idea of training priests or ministers here in the United States. And the reason that this was an issue was because prior to World War II, all of the priests serving in the United States had come from Japan. But now we were living in a new time when there were second and then third generation Japanese Americans who were interested in becoming priests themselves, and the community itself wanted people who were like them, who were American and not from Japan, right? So that study center in the 1950s developed in time into a formal sort of ministerial educational program. And then in the 1960s, it formally incorporated with the state of California as a graduate school and became the Institute of Buddhist Studies. And because of that, I think it's fair to say that the IBS is probably the first organized institution of Buddhist higher education in the United States. It wasn't that long afterwards that places like Naropa University were established out in Boulder, Colorado, and then probably in the 80s or 90s is when the Shilai organization in Los Angeles established University of the West. And there are a couple of other sort of Buddhist universities that are developing right now in the United States. And so this is actually something I didn't talk about at all in the book, but I think it's worth, again, sort of more studies. Right now we're seeing the development of a half dozen different Buddhist schools of higher education that are creating curricula that are inspired by Buddhism or explicitly in line with Buddhist studies as an academic discipline, or are doing things that are like, you know, business schools and whatnot that don't really have anything to do with Buddhism, but are funded by Buddhist organizations or were established by a Buddhist tradition, which is, I think, an interesting development in the history of American higher education and what that might mean for the future. And so I feel quite fortunate to be able to teach in a place like the Institute of Buddhist Studies where we have this sort of long history and this this commitment to Buddhist studies as an academic discipline. And you know, you asked earlier about pan Buddhist organizations. You know, IBS came out of a Jodo Shinshu context, but now we have programs in, you know, Soto Zen studies and Theravada studies and you know, Buddhist chaplaincy and whatever else. And so you know, we're sort of becoming pan Buddhist ourselves in a interesting way. So interesting times, I think.
Yeah. Well, in the interest of time, we're going to have to sort of begin wrapping it up, but I should mention for listeners that there's a whole lot we didn't cover. We didn't even touch on the last two chapters in the book. I should also mention that the book contains useful chapter summaries at the beginning of each chapter and discussion questions and suggestions for further reading at the end of each chapter, which makes it particularly useful for use in the classroom. This would be an excellent book to use as the main text for a class on Buddhism in America. Now, having said that, filled with information and thorough research as it is, the book has much to offer any scholar interested in understanding the history and current state of Buddhism in the U.S. I certainly learned a great deal. Also because it's written in, reads very well, it's accessible, you know, to anyone to people who don't know anything about Buddhism, so it's very approachable. As a last question, Scott, I wanted to ask if there's anything that you're working on now, now that this project is out of the way.
I committed to write a couple of short encyclopedia articles for a couple different Oxford handbooks that are coming out in the next couple of years. But I hope to return my attention to my graduate work was mostly on ritual, actually, on the way in which Buddhism is actually practiced. And I've done some research on Buddhist music and other sorts of practices like that. I hope to be able to turn my attention back to that in the coming year.
Yeah, and you do actually mention at a few places in the book the way in which the Jodo Shinshu, the Japanese Pure Land School in the United States, did actually incorporate music into its services in a rather innovative way, but we'll leave that for discussion of your next research project. So,
yeah, great.
I just wanted to thank you again for taking the time to speak with me today, and that's it for today's New Books in Buddhist Studies. See you next time.